afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 111th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Martha Martinez, who was born in Mexico in 1987 at the age of 5, moved with her family to Texas. There, her family of 6 experienced an aggressive assimilation process, which we will discuss today. And in her adult life, Martha visited Elliott, Maine, 2 to 3 times a year for 15 years to attend meetings at Green Acre Baha'i School. And this past spring, she finally made Maine her home. So welcome to Maine and welcome to New Mainers Speak, Martha.
Thank you so much, Kate, for having me.
Such a pleasure. I've never had anyone from Elliott before. And the truth is, I've never had anyone from Mexico on the show before.
That's so crazy.
Thank you very much for being my first Mexican guest. Everybody, I think, when I first started, thought I would have many Mexican guests because I think for many people, immigration issues are synonymous with being Mexican in the United States. But not in Maine so much. I've met very few Mexicans along the way.
Well, I'm honored to be your first.
Yes,
hopefully there'll be more to come.
I hope so, too. So you come from Mexican parents who had different backgrounds from one another to some extent. Could you tell us about your parents?
Absolutely. Yeah. So both of my parents are from Mexico, born and raised there. My mother comes from a very small coastal town of Mexico, Tecomán. And it really was just a small community of rancheros. And my grandfather was a traditional ranchero, and he grew papaya and tamarindo and all these delicious fruits and lime. That area specifically cultivates lime. When my mother first settled there, there were no schools. There is, I think, just a small elementary school, but for high school and college, they had to, go to a different state in Mexico, where she met my father in Morelia, Michoacán. And he, his upbringing was different. His family heritage, goes back to a Spanish conquistador, and this conquistador actually was one of the founders of this small town called Pátzcuaro. And I think 3 families settled there, all from Spain. And so they intermarried. So my father grew up in this beautiful colonial town called Pátzcuaro. And right now, actually, a lot of people go there to visit. It's just gorgeous. It's a stunning place to visit. So he grew up kind of in a very almost aristocratic family.
And different from ranch life.
Very different from ranch life, yes. A different set of values, but both lovely, lovely families. And I remember going from one world to the next, coming from, actually, my memories, because we immigrated over here when I was 5 years old, and I remember going back to Mexico to visit my family on my mother's side and having a very different, being a part of a different world, one of, hardworking ranchero Mexican life, and then visiting my father's side. And it's like night and day. And here we were, immigrants. It was a very surreal thing to be going from one world to the next.
Sounds like a good novel.
Yes.
And then when you moved to the United States, you said that you dreaded the question, where were you from, when you were a girl in Texas? And I wondered if you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we moved to this small, tiny town. I think it was less than a mile square, called Hutto, Texas. It was the first town we moved to. And we were the second Mexican family to move in. And it had one church. It was a Lutheran church. And one school. And one tiny restaurant. It was a hamburger place. And we moved into a house. And the other Mexican family lived in a trailer. And when we started school, I didn't speak any English. I didn't understand anything. But we could feel that the town was starting to feel a little bit of anxiety about having, you know, outsiders moving in, because it's such a small, close-knit community there. I think everyone in that town went to the same church. And we understood as children that we were very much foreigners. We had a neighbor that, you know, we lived in a small neighborhood, and we had, you know, neighbors on the other side of our house, but there weren't any fences yet. And so, of course, being 5 years old with my other siblings, we would just play in the yard. And I remember one time we were picking up clovers and dandelions, and we found our way to our neighbor's yard, and we started hearing this yelling coming from our neighbor's porch, and we see that he has this rifle out, and he cocks it and, you know, yells at us to go, and we're very frightened that we're like deer caught in headlights, not knowing where to move. And then the next thing I know, we feel water all over us, and we realize this man's urinating on us. And my mother comes running out from the house and takes us back into the house. And, you know, we're told, be careful, don't go to another neighbor's yard, stay within the bounds of your own home. And that became the theme mm-hmm. of our life as children. Like, if you stay within your boundaries, you're safe. If you cross them, whether it's socially, culturally, then you're in danger. And we realized that by being foreign, by being Mexican specifically, there was that was a disadvantage. And it was also felt when we went to school that the teachers were so lovely, so well-intentioned, and they knew this. They knew this would be a dynamic. So they would take us to speech therapy class and would encourage us to speak English only at home. And to, it's not that they told us lose your Mexican language, but it was implied. It was implied that at home you speak English, at school you speak English, you're now in this country. And so bit by bit we started losing our mother tongue as children. And even aspects of our Mexican identity and culture as well.
Sure. Well, there were serious ramifications if you didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's this one story, and it has to do with both sides of my sets of grandparents. It was at a week at school where we were talking about family trees, and everyone had the assignment to bring in photographs of their grandparents. And so I go home, and I ask my mother, Mom, I need a photograph of our grandparents. And so she goes to her bedroom and she brings out a photograph of her mom and dad. And my grandfather is dressed with this traditional cotton Mexican button-up shirt, the kind that you can imagine someone from Cuba wearing, right, with a Cuban cigar, a bandana tied around his neck, a sombrero. He looks hot, sticky, and sweaty. He was probably just coming back from the ranch, and my grandmother next to him, and she's got the Mexican housewife apron on, and they both looked so adorable together. But for me, I was mortified. I thought, oh my goodness, I can't take this picture to school. And I started crying, and I could see my mother's heart just breaking right before my face. And she understood, and we both understood that taking this to school would mean,
you'd never break that stereotype.
I would never break
that
stereotype.
They would see you as that. Yeah.
Absolutely. So then she, with a heavy heart, she goes back to her room and she brings this other photograph of my father's mother. And she looks like a novela star. She won many beauty contests in Mexico and was Miss Mexico. I think it was in 1975. And she has a very particular look to her that at that time people considered the standard of beauty. She had light skin, dirty blonde hair, green eyes, and very much looked like this Spanish soap opera star. And she's wearing actually a traditional Mexican dress. And there's this gentleman serenading her in the picture. But the glamour was just there. You know, it was a black and white photo. And my smile, my tears stopped immediately. And I grew this huge smile. And I think of the smile as this pointy smile that just stabbed my mother's heart. But she understood. That was the picture I was going to take to school. And it, in a sense, it became my shield that I am okay. I'm okay. I'm like you as well. Look, there's light skin in my family. There's green eyes in my family. And it's heartbreaking to say these things now, but in my 5-year-old mind, I understood that those were signs of being okay. It wasn't my brown skin or my brown eyes or that I spoke Spanish. Those things didn't make me okay. So the more I dissociated from that side of myself and the more I assimilated to whiteness, in a sense, the safer I was.
Yeah, staying in your own yard, so to speak.
Yes.
Oh, it's a sad story to reflect on in a way.
It is. It's painful. And to think that, right, I'm 34 years old. I'm not that old. And this was in not that long ago.
Right, 87.
Really, in 87.
Yeah. So, in your family, who do you think was most affected by the move to the United States?
That's a tough one. I think all of us were to certain degrees. My parents, both of them, went through incredible transformation in moving here. I think whenever anyone travels, that you leave your small town or you leave your country, you leave what you know and you become a foreigner somewhere else, it's a transformative experience. And it actually really broadens your understanding of who you are in this world, your sense of self. And I think that really happened to us. It was very scary for my mother to move here. She refused to learn English for many years because she always felt in her heart she was going to go back to Mexico and that the move was temporary. But both of my parents, when you're in a foreign place and you suddenly are in a sea of different values, different ideas, different cultural norms, you do have to somewhat embrace them and then work with it. And then it brings you to think about your traditional values. And so that dialogue is kind of rich, that internal dialogue. I think we were all doing that. My parents were more doing it consciously. As children, we were just kind of in it. And so they both kind of started to develop question things that were maybe traditional norms for them, like, for my mom and dad, the role of the mother in the family, the role of the father. In Mexico, what my parents knew was that the man was the head of the household. There's a very machista culture there. And for the first time, my father was working, kind of self-taught, aerospace engineer, and he was working in this, aerospace engineering company in Texas. And for the first time, he was working with women engineers and, women mathematicians. And he hadn't ever experienced that before. And he was very much intrigued by that. He knew he was raising 3 daughters and 1 son. And he was questioning this idea that the woman is meant to be confined to the home as a wife and homemaker. And he really wanted us as his daughters to advance, to get an education, to develop a profession, to really discover what our talents and abilities are and to refine them. So his search for that started to, I think, being here, it helped him kind of question these traditions and search for something more. And I think for my mother as well, she started to see herself as more than just a housewife, but somebody who has a lot to, capabilities that she can discover herself. So I think, I don't know, for both of them, it was quite transformative.
What a profound transition to make from, that's a huge cultural change, getting inside a family and changing roles inside the family.
Yeah, yeah.
You are listening to WMPG, and if you're just joining us, welcome. This is New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Martha Martinez, originally from Mexico. She's currently working at Greenacre Baha'i School Retreat and Conference Center in Elliott, Maine, as a program coordinator. So Baha'i is a monotheistic religion practiced by 5 million people around the world. Martha, can you tell us about some of the key beliefs of the Baha'i faith?
Absolutely. So the Baha'i faith is an independent religion. Some of the social teachings is that men and women are one. It teaches that religion is also one, that all religions lead back to God, and God is the source of life, and He brings us manifestations of Himself: Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Zoroaster, Moses, and the Bab and Baha'u'llah, who's the latest manifestation of God, is here. And these are divine teachers that bring us new social laws and spiritual understanding to help us advance. And we see humanity as going through a process of maturation. It's growing, it's evolving, it's becoming more and more unified. So if there's like one essential thing about the faith, is this idea of oneness, that we're one human family.
Those are kind of principles that I think are hard to argue with.
Yeah.
We're all one, men and women are equal, everyone benefits from education.
Absolutely, yeah.
Love it.
It's actually part of our story of being immigrants here. I think when my parents moved to Texas, it was a chance for them to explore and discover new things. And, they were born and raised Catholic. Then we moved into this small town. There was only one church. It was the Lutheran church. So we went to that church, and they really took care of us. Then they found a small Mexican Baptist church, and so we went to that church. And I remember, one of the things my father would always ask in his spiritual journey, his search, was what is the role of women and what is the role of the family? And at one point, he was never satisfied with the answer that, well, women have to be obedient and subservient, because it was never working out for us. For some reason, my mother was just too spunky. And he's like, that's just, it doesn't seem to work.
Your dad.
Yes. He didn't want to squander my mom's voice. But they also weren't sure, well, how does this work in a marriage? How does this work in a family? And so we would have the Mormons over, the Jehovah's Witness over, anyone that came knocking on our door, we would invite them in and we would have these conversations. And he would always ask that question, what about my daughters? What is their role in life? And so when he met two Baha'is in his workplace, they were engineers, he was just so intrigued by how these women were empowered as mothers, as professionals, as women. And he thought, I'm going to save them. I'm going to bring them to Jesus. So he would bring the Bible to work. But as they would start having conversations, they would question some of his assumptions. And he would be very intrigued. And one of the things he asked them is, what is the role of women? And they said, well, a woman is the first educator of the children. It's so important that she is supported and empowered to educate herself, because it'll be such a benefit to the children, and that men and women are two wings of the bird. And if one wing is broken, the bird cannot fly. And humanity is essentially that bird, and it has the wing of the woman and the wing of the male, and we have to work together in order for us to soar. And he thought that was so beautiful. So then my parents both became Baha'i, and they actually allowed all of us to decide for ourselves. I actually didn't decide to join the faith until I was 17, and they found it when I was 13 years old. So for us, it was really a huge part of our household is to actually to explore truth for yourself and decide for yourself, you know, what is going to be your set of beliefs. But once you believe in it, that you live by it and you're coherent with it.
Yeah, real values to practice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Green Acre is a very unique and beautiful, beautiful place. This is the Baha'i school, and I wonder if you can tell us about what happens there.
Well, Green Acre has a very interesting history. Sarah Farmer, who founded the inn, had a vision. She had a dream that she was going to create a school, an inn, a space to bring in people from around the world to have discussions and to explore truth and reality. It was one of the first places in the United States for interfaith dialogue. And she brought people from the East. Swami Vivekananda was there, you know, someone who introduced the West to yoga. W.E. Du Bois was there. Artists and thinkers of that time would come to Greenacre to have these deep and meaningful conversations about the state of the world, about spirituality. Later on, she invited... She had Abdu'l-Bahá, who is one of the central figures of the Baha'i Faith, to come to Greenacre. And it's then when she really came in contact with the Baha'i Faith and then became a Baha'i herself. But Greenacre really is a space for that kind of interchange across different religious backgrounds and culture. And it's a space to really explore together topics on life, to explore together truth and... it's a beautiful space. So I ended up going there to work after visiting it for 15 or so years to be a part of that dialogue. And now I'm there trying to create that space and open it to more and more people around the seacoast.
Yes. And so I'm humbled to think that I've never been to Elliott before. And I went down last week and got a tour of Green Acre, which is feels like a time envelope. You know, you step into mm-hmm. something else, like a Shaker Village. You know, there's something else happening in this space. Mm. Beautiful, well-kept buildings right on the Piscataqua River. And I think you have a gorgeous space in which to work and live and create kind of a utopic practice of one's values. It's a powerful place.
Yeah, I feel very lucky to be there. It's really lovely. And many people come to visit it, not just Baha'is. You know, we have people from the Hindu religion come to visit it as well. We have people actually, hopefully, you know, the farmers were, their home was part of the Underground Railroad. They were really ahead of their time and believed in the sense of that we're, you know, one human family and that, if one group of people suffers, we're all suffering. And so this space really embodies that. And we hope more and more people can come and just share in it. It's really a very special place.
If you're interested in learning more, that's very findable at greenacre.org. And you could learn about what's going on at the center and see pictures of this gorgeous place.
Absolutely.
Is there another way you would recommend people get in touch if they're interested in learning more?
Yeah, well, we're going to take part in
Elliott Days?
Elliott Days, yes. Elliott Days. It's the last weekend of September. And so usually we have a turkey dinner and, the campus will be open for anybody. It's open all the time for any visitors except for Mondays when it's typically closed. But anyone can come. And we have this beautiful prayer room. People can come and just say prayers or meditate on the grass. But then you can also take part in our family programs that we offer as well that will be on our website.
Great. So your family of four females and two males experienced a major shift away from traditional sex roles and toward more collaborative connections through your faith practices. I wonder if you might share how you narrate your life stories to one another and what that tends to do for your family relationships.
Well, I think our family story, you know, when I talk about it in 2 or 3 minutes, it feels like it can be easily romanticized, but we went through so much hardship. I think when anyone goes through a transformative experience or they, you know, immigrate from one country to another, it's not an easy thing. We grew up poor. My father was raising a family of six with, you know, a salary that was under $25,000 a year. And, but I think as we started to think about this concept of equality, of family unity, and practice it, it's interesting. At first, unity meant that we all agreed with my father, and consultation meant that we all agreed. But then as my mother started to develop her own voice through her Baha'i practice, suddenly consultation wasn't that we all agreed with my father. Consultation was dynamic. It was okay to disagree. It was okay to have a clash of opinions, because there you can have a spark of truth and discover something new. But that's not an easy thing to do when you're used to another, you know, traditional way of conversation, of making decisions. And so it was actually really, really hard and very painful. And there was a moment where we thought our family was not going to survive this change. But I think we all, you know, during hardship, stuck together as a family, but then also reached out to community. And so we realized actually having families come together to talk about what they're trying to learn. What does it mean to you to have family unity? What does it mean to you in your experience as a family to practice this idea of equality of men and women? I don't think anyone knows what that looks like, but we can learn about it together. And from that, we started to narrate our experience in that frame, that there's this old way of being that's falling apart. At the same time, we're developing a new way of being. And so that became a powerful way to actually deal with the trauma of change.
Well, thank you for saying that, because I think it is easy to romanticize once you've gotten safely to the other side of your transformation, and transformations are painful. And that's beautiful, the way you recapitulate that. Martha, you are an authentically kind person with a belief in one human family that you regularly put into a practice. And I'm so impressed by your intentional work toward peace, inclusion, and understanding. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me. It's such an honor, really.
I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest, Martha Martinez. Would you be so kind as to introduce the song you selected to close today's program, Martha?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is my favorite Mexican ballad. It's called Malagueña Salerosa. And my grandmother would sing it in an out-of-pitch voice, but I loved it. But it's one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Bonitos ojos tienes debajo de esas dos cejas, debajo de esas dos cejas. Qué bonitos ojos tienes. Ellos me quieren mirar, pero si tú no los dejas, pero si tú no los dejas, ni siquiera parpadear. Malagueña salerosa, besar tus labios quisiera, besar tus labios quisiera. Malagueña salerosa, Malagueña salerosa, y decir.